Welcome to Game Changers, the official podcast of the Women's Sports Museum. I'm your host, Courtney Crawford, and today we are joined by a wonderful guest, the president of the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum and a dear friend, Bob Kendrick. The Negro Leagues Baseball Museum, also known as NLBM, is the world's only museum dedicated to preserving and celebrating the rich history of African American baseball and its impact on the social advancement of America. Bob is a baseball historian and host of XM Radio's award-winning podcast, Black Diamonds. We'll be sharing the stories of the Negro Leagues along with the pioneering woman of baseball. Bob, thank you so much for joining us. I'm so excited to speak with you.
It is great to see you. And thank you so much for having me on the show.
So the NLBM was established in 1990 in the heart of Kansas City, Missouri, in the historic 18th and Vine Jazz District, and operates just two blocks from Paseo YMCA, where Andrew Rube Foster established the Negro National League in 1920. Can you tell us a little bit more about how the museum came about and how it's grown to what it is today?
It's an amazing story in itself, Courtney, because we started in a little one-room office in 1990 inside the historic Lincoln Building, where it was a third floor office space, not much bigger than the office that I'm sitting in now, recording this interview with you and someone I know you knew and loved dearly, the late, great Buck O'Neill.
Yes.
And other local Negro Leaguers who were still with us at that time. Sad to say they've all passed on now, but they literally took turns paying the monthly rent to keep that little office open. And as I like to say, with it, our hopes and dreams of one day building a facility that would pay rightful tribute to not only one of the greatest chapters in baseball history, but what now thousands of visitors each and every year discover, one of the greatest chapters in American history.
Exactly.
And so here we were, this little fledgling museum anchored here at historic 18th and Vine, the Jazz District. And during that era of segregation, one of the most significant African-American communities anywhere in the country at that time. And it had died. 18th and Vine had died. Like a lot of urban areas, mm-hmm. it had died. And really, you can trace that back to the demise of the Negro Leagues that led so many of those urban communities to kind of flounder. And here in Kansas City, the city literally had turned its back on 18th and Vine. And here we come talking about building a Negro Leagues museum here. And as you can well imagine, some of our most ardent supporters were questioning the decision to anchor here. And I can understand why, because the sentiment was, well, who's going to come see you? There was no built-in foot traffic. But thanks to the infinite wisdom of old Buck, who said, this is where the origins of the Negro Leagues began. This is where we will build this museum. And in doing so, we will help resurrect what was once a tremendously proud and prominent African-American community. That was in 1990. Here we are now, over three decades later, recognized as America's National Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. So yes, it has been an incredible journey for a little museum that no one gave any chance of succeeding. But just as important as our own success has been, people are living and working and playing at 18th and Vine again. And so Buck knew exactly what he was talking about when he convinced us all that this was the place for us to anchor and establish this museum.
That's so wonderful. He would be so proud. And was one of my absolute favorite people, not only in all of baseball and all of sports. Can you tell us a little bit about Buck and who he was? Because we have to pay homage to him since he did build this on his back, of course, as well.
No question. He, for me, was one of the most remarkable human beings to ever walk the face of this earth, who just happened to be a great baseball player. But his human qualities far outweighed his talent on the baseball field. And of course, last year, he was finally inducted into the National Baseball Hall of Fame.
Yes.
I met Buck for the very first time in 1993. as I was then volunteering for the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. Who knew? I start here as a volunteer, and now I get to try and lead this incredible institution. And when I met Buck for the very first time, Cord, one of the things I asked, one of the first questions that I asked him was, Buck, what motivated you to want to build a Negro Leagues Baseball Museum? And his answer was succinct, but also very poignant, so that we would be remembered.
Yes.
He did not want us to forget them for what not only did they give the game, but for what they did to help advance this country socially. And that set him on this quest. And I can tell you, I was tremendously blessed to have had the opportunity to travel all over the country and hang out with Buck O'Neill, and they paid me to do it. Yeah, now I would have done that for free. And oftentimes ask me what I remember the most about Buck. And as you can well know, there are so many things. I mean, we traveled so much together. We played golf together. There were breakfast, lunch, dinner, car rides, plane rides, and so much wisdom that he would throw out there. He didn't force it on you. It was there for you to take it if you wanted to. And the smartest thing that I ever did was I kept my mouth closed and I listened. But the thing that I share with folks about what I remember most about Buck is that you always felt better leaving Buck than you did when you came to see him. No matter what might have been going on in your world at that time, once you encountered Buck O'Neill, it seemed to be meaningless.
Yes.
You know, whatever those troubles were, no matter if it was aches and pains or whatever it was, it seemed to all go away when you were in the presence of Buck O'Neill. And there are not many people who strike you that way. And he just had this innateness about him that gave him the ability to see the good in everyone, even when they weren't good. Buck always saw the good in them. And so it was a blessing to be around him. I miss him dearly. I tell people there's not a single day that passes by that I don't think about Buck. And in all sincerity, I talk to Buck almost every single day. Now, he doesn't always talk back to me, but I still have those conversations. And for me, as I'm so fortunate to serve in this role as president of the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum, having taken the baton from Buck O'Neill and now walking in his enormous shoes, because, Courtney, you would be naive to think that you could feel his shoes. You can't. And there would be a lot of people who would maybe crumble under the weight of Buck's shadow. But for me, it's a blessing to have Buck's shadow over me. And honestly, I feel like he guides my footsteps.
I was just going to say
that. Yeah, I really do. Mm-hmm. And because, you know, every crazy idea that I've seemingly come up with, it is worth. And I'm not that smart. So I know I'm getting a little help. I'm getting a little help from somebody, and I think it's my friend Buck O'Neill.
Absolutely. Well, I think he would be equally proud to know what you have been doing with the museum since, and that you tirelessly, you know, are developing different programs both within Major League Baseball and around the country in different ballparks, including your own backyard, right, with the Kansas City Royals, to make sure that the Negro Leagues are always remembered and very much a relevant part of today's learning and American history.
Yeah, and so, no, I mean, that's exactly what we're trying to do. And I think you hit the nail right on the head because, you know, to preserve this history certainly is noteworthy and needed. But I think the challenge for any museum, particularly a history museum, and even more so a cultural institution like the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum, is the challenge of how do you establish relevancy? Mm-hmm. How do you connect this history, a history, Courtney, that hadn't been played in over 60 years, six decades? How do you make a connection with an ever-changing generation of young people so that they are engaged in this? Exactly. And so we are constantly challenging ourselves to find those points of connectivity and create interest in that new generation whom some who I think have falsely assumed that young people don't care about history. Of course they care about history. They do. But it does become incumbent on how that history is presented to them. And I can't wait for them to come to me. I've got to go to them, and I have to go to them in the modes and mediums that they are accustomed to getting their information. And that's what we're attempting to do here at the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum.
Excellent. Excellent. And very forward thinking and you know, relevant, of course. And on that note, since you recently shared with me that Major League Baseball is in collaboration with you, the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum, to create a series of short videos that are animations, in fact, telling the story of the Negro Leagues. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about that since that was just released?
The series is entitled, and I think aptly entitled Undeniable. And what I love about Undeniable is that it is undeniably cool.
Yes.
Because we've tapped into animation to bring the story of the Negro Leagues to life in a tremendous partnership and collaboration with Major League Baseball, an animated firm called Invisible Collective, and Martian Blueberry. And they allowed me to lend my voice and insight to this animated project. But as you can well imagine, this now opens us up even more so to a new generation of folks who will love this animated look at the Negro Leagues, but they're going to learn something in the first episode, which is being released at the time that you and I are recording this, is on the women of the Negro Leagues. Mm. And it was so much fun. And I hope people love this as much as I loved actually helping produce this. And again, I hope it gives people an indication of that forward thinking that this museum has undertaken in terms of how we do connect with a different generation of people and hopefully see them fall in love with the Negro Leagues as well. And as you could well imagine, it's going to be eye-opening for so many to learn that there were women who played professionally in the Negro Leagues. I oftentimes hear people say, well, one day a woman will play in the major leagues. And I'm saying to them, no, that one day has already happened. It's just a matter of, will it happen again? Mm-hmm. You know, you had these three pioneering women who called the Negro Leagues home. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Toni Stone, Mamie Peanut Johnson, and Connie Morgan. They were pioneers, women who competed with and against the men in the Negro Leagues in the 1950s. And so this animated series looks at that aspect of Black baseball history. There will be a subsequent release that looks at the international appeal of Black baseball. And then one that looks at a fairly unknown story about the great Monty Irvin, who could have been the first. As a matter of fact, he was Branch Rickey's first choice to break baseball's color barrier. But it ultimately rolled over and Jackie Robinson became the chosen one.
Right.
And there's a unique story there that will be shared in an animated capacity. And again, I do hope that people enjoy watching these. These are available on all of the MLB platforms, MLB.com original, MLB TV, and the MLB app. And of course, they'll also be available eventually on the museum's website as well.
Excellent. Thank you for letting us know how we can watch it and tune in. And what ages would you say this is geared towards?
I think this is going to be geared toward probably preschool age all the way up to grown kids like myself, my age. I think we'll all enjoy it. You know, I sat down and I had a chance just yesterday to actually sit down and watch the full length episode. You know, I'd been doing the voiceovers and they came here and we shot video and that whole nine yards, but I hadn't seen the finished pieces until just the day that it was announced that they were going to release this series. And it's fascinating. And animation works.
Yes.
I've always felt like animation would be a very cool way to tell the story of the Negro Leagues and grab the interest in this subject matter. And I think they hit the mark with this.
It definitely brings these stories to life in a digital format that people can relate to on a different level, perhaps, or maybe from what their imaginations, you know, envisioned the Negro League experience to be like.
Well, you think about this storytelling, and Buck was one of the great storytellers. The greatest compliment that people share with me is that they say that the way that you tell the story, I felt like I was there. And I think for any storyteller, that's what you want to happen. You want to engage them in such a way that they can envision what it was like, this matchup between Satchel Paige and Josh Gibson. You know, and that feel like I'm there in the ballpark. Mm. Well, there's no video of, you know, of many of these stories that are being shared. But with animation, you no longer just have to paint the picture. You can create the picture and you can see what it's like to go along with the story. And to me, that is what's so really special and cool about that aspect and that feature, why I thought animation lend itself beautifully to bringing the stories of the Negro Leagues alive.
I'm so glad that they also highlight the female athletes of and trailblazers of the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. Well, Negro Leagues, I'm sorry. But yeah, they're also of the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum, because I've been there and seen them for, you know, front and center, highlighted in the museum as well. And before we dive further into those female trailblazers, or as we like to call game changers on our podcast too, can you give us a brief history of the Negro Leagues and its place in history for those who might be a little less familiar with it?
Oh, absolutely. Well, the leagues were formed here in Kansas City on February 13, 1920, by Andrew Rube Foster, the genius. Rube Foster would lead a group of 8 independent Black baseball team owners into a meeting that was held at the Pacelle YMCA just right around the corner from where we currently operate. And of course, we're now saving that historic landmark, and it's going to be converted into the future Buck O'Neill Education and Research Center. So we're going full circle right back to the building that gave birth to the story that we're now charged with preserving. So the Negro Leagues, of course, for those who may not be familiar, they were established because African Americans and Hispanic athletes were shunned from the major leagues. Mm-hmm. And for me, what makes this story so significant is they didn't cry about the social injustice. Mm-hmm. They went out and did something about it. You won't let me play with you, I'll create a league of my own. Mm-hmm. That league, as I mentioned, was established right here in Kansas City. So for those who sometimes wonder why a Negro Leagues museum is in Kansas City, it is indeed because Kansas City is the birthplace of the Negro Leagues. Mm. What oftentimes surprises people, though, is the depth of the story. These leagues, Courtney, would operate for 40 years, from 1920 until 1960. And of course, most baseball fans can relate to the fact that Jackie Robinson breaks Major League Baseball's color barrier in 1947. But 13 years after Jackie breaks the color barrier, the Negro Leagues are still operating, and operating with a relative degree of success. But when we look back in time, we discover that it took Major League Baseball 12 years before every Major League team had at least one Black baseball player. The Boston Red Sox would become the last team to integrate in 1959 when they signed a guy by the name of Elijah Pumpsey Green, which ultimately pushed the Negro Leagues out of business. The Negro Leagues ceased operations in 1960 because by then, their best young Black stars had moved into the major leagues or into their minor league system, and there was no replenishing system. Mm-hmm. So this league emerged to give both Black and brown baseball players an opportunity to showcase their world-class baseball abilities. Mm-hmm. But as I oftentimes remind our guests, you can never reduce the story of the Negro Leagues to just baseball. This story is far more grandiose than baseball. This is a story about the importance of economic empowerment. This is a story about an unprecedented level of leadership that emerged as a result of the formation of these various Negro Leagues over that 40-year period of time. And ultimately, this is the story of the social advancement of America, as Jackie Robinson is handpicked from the great Kansas City Monarchs to break Major League Baseball's six-decade-long self-imposed color barrier. Jackie Robinson's career began right here in Kansas City in 1945. And I do believe, Court, that people think that Jackie just walked out of nowhere and started playing for the Brooklyn Dodgers.
Exactly.
But his real, but his real rookie season was here in Kansas City. Right. And I remind our guests, the time that he spent in Kansas City, all of 5 months, he fell in love with everything that Kansas City is famous for. Barbecue and jazz.
There you go.
He liked the ribs at a place called Old Kentuck Barbecue. Old Kentuck Barbecue would become the forerunner of the great Gates barbecue chain of restaurants. And I know you've had a rib from Gates on one of your trips here to Kansas City.
Absolutely. It'll keep you coming back, that's for sure, if not for the museum itself. There's a lot to love in Kansas City.
And he fell deeper in love, because I would already believe that he was already a jazz aficionado. Mm. But he fell deeper in love with jazz, because while New Orleans may lay claim to jazz, Kansas City gave jazz its soul. And 5 months later, Jackie was gone. He had literally disappeared. His teammates had no idea where he was. Well, as we know, he was meeting with Branch Rickey, and they would make that monumental decision that he would become the chosen one to break baseball's color barrier. And of course, we make the bold assertion that Jackie Robinson's breaking of the color barrier was not just a part of the civil rights movement. It was actually the beginning of the civil rights movement. Because again, this is 1947. This predates those more noted civil rights occurrences.
Right.
So this is before Brown versus the Board of Education. Mm-hmm. This is before Rosa Parks' refusal to move to the back of the bus. As old Buck would say, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was a sophomore at Morehouse College in Atlanta, Georgia, when Jackie signed his contract to play in the Dodgers organization, our very own President Harry S. Truman, Independence, Missouri, would not integrate the armed forces until a year after Jackie. So for all intents and purposes, this is what started the ball of social progress rolling in our country. And see, all of that is woven into this wonderful story of these courageous athletes who, when it's all said and done, Court, they just wanted to play ball.
Right.
Yeah, they just wanted to play ball. They had no idea they were making history. They didn't care about making history. They just wanted to play ball. And so that is what makes this story so profound, so awe-inspiring. It is bigger than the game of baseball, but when it's all said and done, it's still just a tiny part of the great story of the game of baseball.
Yes, and a great story it is. And the people who used to attend those games were incredibly passionate fans as well, and to the point where the Sunday services were pushed back an hour. Is that right? So
that is right.
So the attendees could come, or fans could come dressed to the nines and catch their baseball as well as be their good, you know, as well as go to church at the same time.
Else you weren't going to have anybody in at a time.
Exactly.
So that service time up an hour so fans could leave to go to those Sunday doubleheaders. And as you mentioned, they were dressed to the nines, looking good. You know, every now and then an idea comes along and you wish it was your idea. Now, years later, I'll probably lie and swear it was my idea, but it wasn't my idea. Two young white kids approached me a number of years ago. And they said, Mr. Kendrick, what do you think about an idea to see if we can get fans to dress up like they used to going to see Monarch games? Hmm. And we want to call it Dress to the Nines. And the first words that came out of my mouth was, damn, how come I didn't think of that? It was just brilliant. And so we started a social media campaign. The first time we did it was on Jackie Robinson Day. And it was just a couple of weeks or so before that game was going to happen. And so the Royals didn't have enough time to really wrap their arms around it. We did a social media campaign, but we were able to get a couple hundred people to meet us at the cave. Everybody was dressed up. And you could see people looking like, what in the world is going on? Well, the Royals loved the idea so much that the very next year, they put some PR power and muscle behind it And now we get thousands of people who come out to the ball game, one game out of the year, put on their Sunday best and represent the spirit of the fans who attended those Negro League games. I call it the most fashionable day in baseball.
It certainly is. And it was one of my favorite baseball games to attend. In fact, what I loved was that both teams were wearing throwback jerseys. So we had the Kansas City Monarchs as the Kansas City Royals. And I don't remember which team, if it was maybe the Grays when I was there, potentially. But I love that you get to actually feel like you're watching an old baseball game in modern day.
They do the throwback unis, and then they auction them off with all the proceeds coming back to the museum. So the players sign the game used jerseys, the other game used items from that throwback game. And we've been able to generate significant revenue through the sale. The Dodgers were in town last season for this game, and we had record revenue from those unis because, again, the Dodgers are so big. They have a huge fan base. And so those game-worn items went for a premium, and the Royals are so generous to donate those proceeds right back to the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum.
Yes. So, Bob, how many teams were in the Negro Leagues, roughly?
You know, over that 40-year time span, Courtney, nearly 100 cities were impacted by Black baseball as teams would emerge, fold, relocate. And so many parts of the country, mainly east of the Mississippi River, got an opportunity to experience Negro Leagues baseball.
Now let's dive into the stories of the female game changers of the Negro Leagues. Who was the most prolific female game changer in the Negro Leagues?
Well, from a playing perspective, it had to be Toni Stone because she was the first. Yes. But from just a baseball perspective, Effa Manley.
Absolutely.
Effa Manley, who is affectionately called the Queen of the Negro Leagues, was one of three pioneering, well, one of several women, I should say, that were owners or leaders or executives of Negro League teams. Hilda Bolden, Minnie Forbes, Olivia Taylor, but Effa Manley is by far the most notable and was a powerful owner. Effa Manley and her husband Abe owned the Newark Eagles, but it was Mrs. Manley who ran the day-to-day operations of that baseball team, and she knew the business of baseball as well as any man, had tremendous talent play for her. My dear friend, the late, great Monty Irvin, Larry Doby, who, as you know, would integrate the American League just weeks after Jackie breaks the color barrier in the National League with Brooklyn. Larry Doby would integrate the American League with Cleveland, then the Cleveland Indians, now, of course, the Cleveland Guardians. Raleigh Biz Mackey, Leon Day, Don Newcomb all played for Effa Manley's Newark Eagles. When the Negro Leagues were on the verge of collapse, as Branch Rickey and others were starting to kind of come in and steal that talent or were preparing to steal that talent, who did they send to fight Branch Rickey? Effa Manley. And so she is the first woman to be nominated and inducted into the National Baseball Hall of Fame. And of course, there's a wonderful play on the life of Toni Stone. It started off Broadway in New York and written by an outstanding playwright named Lydia Diamond. Toni Stone was fascinating. And Toni Stone took the roster place of someone that your listening audience have likely heard of before, the great Henry Aaron. Yeah, the Henry Aaron began his career with the Indianapolis Clowns in 1952 when the Boston Braves signed him away 3 months later. And then eventually the Boston Braves would become the Milwaukee Braves, who, of course, would become the Atlanta Braves. Well, the very next year in 1953, the Indianapolis Clowns filled his roster plays by signing Toni Stone. All three women were very talented athletes. Was there a marketing aspect to it? Of course it was. The Negro Leagues were losing their primary male fan base, and so they wanted to attract a female clientele. But you know, everything that we do has a marketing aspect to it. We're trying to sell whatever it is that we have to offer. So it does not diminish the unique talent that these ladies possess. Toni Stone, tremendous athlete. Mamie Peanut Johnson, who I got to know and had the esteemed honor of speaking at her funeral services in 2017, and Connie Morgan, who hailed from Philadelphia. They could play. They could play. And of course, they had to deal with not only racism, but they also had to deal with sexism. And yet they, again, showed the fortitude enough to prove that they belong. Yeah, I'm sure there were some men questioning this. You know, what you doing out here? As a matter of fact, that's how Peanut Johnson got her nickname, a great player, leadoff hitter for the Monarchs named Hank Bayless. And this is his first time facing Mamie Johnson, who was one of the pitchers, well, the only pitcher of the three women. And Mamie's on the mound, and Hank Bayless peers out at her, and he says in this very condescending fashion, "What you doing out there? You ain't no bigger than a peanut." Probably struck him out. And she was Peanut from that day on.
I love that story.
But it's like anything else in this world of ours. You're constantly trying to prove yourself. And once those ladies proved that they belong, they earned the respect of those men.
And Mamie Peanut Johnson was only 5'3" and 98 pounds for those who want to picture just how powerful that little pint-sized peanut was on the mound.
And of course, she was the only one of the three women that wanted to try out for the All-American Girls Professional League.
Right.
And of course, as you all know, that was the league that inspired the hit film, A League of Their Own. Well, if you saw the film, you may recall there's one scene in the film where the ball gets loose and the sister picks it up and she fires it back in and everybody's looking in astonishment. Well, Penny Marshall directed that film. That was Penny Marshall's ode to the late, great Mamie Peanut Johnson.
Excellent. That gave me the chills. I love that scene. Connie Morgan played alongside Mamie Peanut Johnson. Is that right? So they had, the two of them were actually both on the Indianapolis Clowns at the same time. So they had the support of one another, which is great.
Whereas, Tony was playing for herself.
Right. So did Tony face a little bit more adversity being the first in terms of?
Yeah, no question. There's no question. And the play that I reference brings that out. Yeah, she had to do things where she couldn't stay in the same places as her male teammates. Sometimes she'd have to stay at brothels.
Right.
And but, you know, it was really interesting to see how those women kind of took care of her.
Right.
You know, as they were coming into these towns. And so she did face a lot of adversity, and she took a lot of that, and maybe it sheltered the other ladies who would eventually follow her, because that's always the challenge of the first.
Right.
And she shouldered it tremendously. And Toni Stone is a significant figure in both baseball and American history.
And I remember reading that Sid Pollack, who had signed Toni Stone, had asked her to wear a skirt or a dress, just as they did in the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League. And she refused. She put her foot down and said, "Nope, I'm not wearing a skirt. I'm going to play in a man's uniform, in a true baseball uniform." And so she did.
Now, she wasn't having that. And so she put on her baseball uniform just like the fellas did. And honestly, that's what she wanted to be. She wanted to be accepted as one of the fellas. And eventually she did earn that respect from her teammates, as well as the opposition that they all had to face.
Yes. Yes. And let's see, can we go back to Effa Manley for a little bit? I would love to hear a couple of stories on Effa Manley, just because I've tuned into your Black Diamonds podcast and how phenomenal it is, and was really blown away by everything I learned about her, not only to the level of her being a hard-nosed businesswoman who was in fact very beautiful on the outside, but how the ballplayers respected her, who she signed, how she led the ball club, and how other owners also in fact utilized her in terms of negotiations.
It was really interesting because as Monty Irvin would say, and this is the measure of Negro League ownership, she never missed a payday.
Right.
Yeah. And for those ball players, There were some ball players who played on some other teams. They would eventually get paid, but they didn't always get paid on time.
Right.
And as Bobby would say, Mrs. Manley never missed a payday. And she is a controversial kind of figure. First and foremost, because there is still this question around her ethnicity. There are some who believe that she was biracial. Her mother was white, that her father was Black. There are others who believe that she was the byproduct of an affair that her mother had with a white man, that she was actually white.
Right.
Well, regardless, she could have passed as white because she was very light-skinned. She could have very easily passed as white, yet she chose to assimilate to Black culture at a time when being Black wasn't exactly the most popular thing that you could do. But yet she was also court savvy enough to use her whiteness that would allow her to stay in places that other folks couldn't stay, shop in places that other folks couldn't shop. But then on the flip side, she would lead the, she had no lynching day rallies at the ballpark. She was at the forefront of the don't shop where you can't, don't work, don't shop where you can't work movement there in Newark that had incredible impact in opening up opportunities for Blacks to work in some of those department stores in Newark. And so she was very proactive with the NAACP. And you're right. The initially, the Negro League owners saw her as this kind of meddlesome, know-it-all woman. But yet when Branch Rickey came seeking out those Negro League players, they sent Effa Manley to deal with him. And to be honest, she didn't care for Branch Rickey. And she had every right not to care for Branch Rickey because Mrs. Manley saw exactly what Rickey was going to do. Branch Rickey was going to come into the Negro Leagues and essentially raid it of its star talent without any compensation to their owners.
Right.
And she was prepared to fight him. So Branch Rickey initially wanted Monty Irvin. Now, in fact, he had signed Monty Irvin prior to coming to get Jackie Robinson. But Mrs. Manley was prepared to litigate. And Branch Rickey now had to think about this. He did not need a public fight with someone who was at least identified as Black around this Black man trying to play in the major leagues. He didn't need that public fight because you already know that the other owners were already going to stand in solidarity to try and block this anyway. And so he backs off of Monty Irvin. And that's when he turns his sight to Kansas City and Jackie Robinson. And so Mrs. Manley was able to fight him off. But at that point in time, she knew that blood was in the water and the sharks were coming. She wasn't going to be able to continually fight them off. And so here comes Bill Veeck. Bill Veeck comes, but Bill Veeck comes offering $5,000 for Larry Doby. And Mrs. Manley writes to Bill Veeck and she says, Mr. Veeck, now you know if Larry Doby was white, he'd be worth $100,000 or more. But if you believe this sum of $5,000 is fair, I guess I have no alternative but to accept this. Well, Bill Veeck, who had a heart for this, Bill Veeck had threatened to buy the Philadelphia team and fill it with Negro League stars. And then Judge Kennesaw Mountain Landis nixed the deal when he heard about this. And so Bill Veeck came with a counteroffer, said, I'll give you $5,000 more and I'll give Larry a $5,000 signing bonus if he makes the team. That is what ultimately set the stage for Negro League owners to now start to sell their star players to the major leagues. Right. And it's all through the tenacity of Effa Manley.
Right. Right. That's an incredible story and a valuable one too. And the way she was with the players was equally both fair. She was a great leader to them and also she cared about their well-being, but also was a when it came to their contracts or them wanting a raise, she really analyzed their previous season's performances and decided accordingly whether they earned that or not.
No, she was a shrewd negotiator, and she really was. But she loved that team. She cared about that team. They won her a championship in 46. Mm-hmm. They beat Buck and the Kansas City Monarchs. Uh-huh. And Buck was always heartbroken over that World Series loss. It was an exciting seven-game series, and the Eagles won it 4-3 with Leon Day, Hall of Famer Leon Day, making a great diving catch on a Buck O'Neill line drive that Buck thought was going to drive in the winning run. Here comes Leon Day out of nowhere to rob Buck of a hit and a chance for a game-winning RBI. Mm-hmm. And Buck, I don't think Buck ever forgot that.
I don't think
so. She was the toast of town there in Newark, and she was absolutely adored by the Eagle fans for what her contributions, not only through baseball, but her contributions to the community there in Newark.
And her social impact, yes. So do we know all there is to know about the involvement of women in the Negro Leagues? And how do you acquire the information that you do? Is it all through records and through?
Yeah, you know, in New Jersey, in the library, they have Effa Manley's scrapbook, these incredible letters that she wrote. Those kinds of things are so tremendously helpful. Mm-hmm. There are some oral histories from Toni Stone, as well as Effa Manley. So, you know, you just try and scour as much as you can to kind of put the pieces together. Mm-hmm. But also, much credit has to be given to all the Negro League historians and researchers, you know, because they are continually trying to unearth materials and share them. And they've done a tremendous job, which is what ultimately led us to Major League Baseball acknowledging the Negro Leagues for exactly what we knew it to be, a major league. But as much work has been done, there's still that much more work remaining to be done, because there are all of these kind of hidden gems, these wonderful stories that we need to share. And we're continually working to try and unearth them and bring them, you know, bring them to the forefront. But before I got involved with this museum, I had no idea that women played in the Negro League, or that there were owners who were women in the Negro League. Well, before I got involved with this museum, I really didn't know a whole lot about the Negro League. I knew enough to be dangerous. You know, like most baseball fans, I knew the names Satchel Paige, Cool Papa Bell, Josh Gibson, because they're transcending kinds of names. Most baseball fans have at least heard the name. Now, according to, they may not know just how great of players they were, but you likely heard the names.
Right.
But what really grabbed me was the breadth, the depth, the scope, the magnitude that this history represented both on and off the field.
Absolutely.
And honestly, it is the off the field aspect that I think grabs me more so than anything else. Third largest Black-owned business in this country.
Yes.
The impact that it had in spawning other Black businesses. You know, these things would have never been brought forward if it's not for an institution like the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum.
Absolutely. Bob, we're almost coming to our to the end of our interview, but I did want to ask you, what are some of the most precious and exciting pieces of memorabilia that the museum holds?
There are some really cool pieces. You know, I believe that the Paseo YMCA, which we own, is the most significant Negro Leagues artifact in existence. Now, people don't always look at the buildings as being an artifact, but that's the birthplace. That's the birthplace of the story that we are now charged with preserving.
Right.
But 2 years ago, well, now almost 3 years ago, we acquired the Financial Journal of Andrew Rube Foster. And if the YMCA is the most significant artifact, I believe that this is a close number two.
Absolutely.
Because sometimes lost in the romantic nature of these courageous athletes, talented courageous athletes who overcame tremendous social adversity to play the game that they love, is that, again, Negro Leagues Baseball was the third largest Black-owned business in this country. It only trailed Black-owned insurance companies who emerged during that era of American segregation and would basically insure us more than the 10 to 15 cents that the white insurance companies would insure African Americans. They would just insure us enough to bury us. Black-owned insurance companies came about and not only insured my livelihood, mm-hmm. but insured my stock, my crop, my home, and as a result, made millions of dollars. Mm-hmm. Next was Madam C.J. Walker, who would become this country's first self-made businesswoman millionaire of any skin color doing black hair.
Right.
She had schools of cosmetology in every major urban mm-hmm. center in this country, becoming the first woman to earn $1 million with a business structure. And then next was Negro Leagues Baseball. And so this financial journal meticulously documents every business transaction that took place in the Negro Leagues from 1920 through 1925, prior to Ruth Foster getting sick and could no longer serve in his role as president of the Negro Leagues. Mm-hmm. And so it is one of the holy grails of Negro Leagues memorabilia. And so that piece is proudly on display here at the Negro Leagues Museum now, but there are a number of pieces that I just absolutely adore. We got a gold pocket watch that belonged to the legendary Leroy Satchel Paige. Mm-hmm. Beautiful Elgin gold pocket watch wow. that was presented to him on Satchel Paige Day at Wrigley Field in Chicago in 1942. Mm-hmm. Now, mind you, they didn't play many games at Wrigley. The Negro Leagues played more of their games on the South Side in Comiskey Park. But this was one of those rare games in the Satchel Paige Day and the Chicago Defender, the great African-American newspaper, presented Satchel with the gold pocket watch. And Courtney, inscribed on the back of the watch, says, "To the world's greatest pitcher from the world's greatest newspaper." Uh-huh. And we acquired that years ago. And it's a beautiful timepiece for a player who was timeless. Mm-hmm. Yeah, ageless.
He uh-huh. was ageless.
Yeah, that's ageless. For sure. Yeah. And so you'll see those kinds of pieces on display here at the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum.
That and so much more from so the bronze more. Sculptures and oh, the ball definitely. Field. It's
yes, which gives you chills.
Yes.
I'm biased, but I think it is one of the most amazing displays in any museum anywhere in the world. And it's known as the Field of Legends. Mm. And it's this mock baseball diamond that houses 10 of 12 of our life-size bronze sculptures of Negro League greats. And they're all anchored in position as if they're playing a game. And they represent the first group of Negro Leaguers to be inducted into the National Baseball Hall of Fame at Cooperstown. And it's the very last thing that happens here at the Negro Leagues Museum. You've gone through the entire experience. You've bared witness to the hardships and the challenges, but also the joy that these players had in playing this game and how they overcame this adversity. Yes. And then the last thing that happens is you can now take the field. You've earned the right
yes.
to walk out on the field, as I like to say, with 10 of the baddest brothers to ever play this game.
That they were. Bob, thank you so much for joining us today. It was such a pleasure speaking with you, as always. For everyone listening, I hope you plan a trip to visit the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. You will be so happy you did. You can visit the museum online at nlbm.com and follow Bob Kendrick on Instagram and Twitter at nlbmprez. That's nlbmprez. And on behalf of the Women's Sports Museum, I want to especially thank you all for being here with us and would like to invite you to visit us at womansportsmuseum.org. Have a game changer you want to hear interviewed on our podcast? Email us at podcast@womansportsmuseum.org. If you enjoyed this episode, we would love your continued support. Please take a moment to give us a 5-star rating and review. Doing so will help get our podcast out to more listeners like you. Until next time,